Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Next up, News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip. Hey, everybody. It's just Stacy this week. If you follow Sarah's blog and Facebook page, you know that she had a little internet trouble. So we've decided to put together a best of show for you. If I am doing the math correctly, this is actually episode 26, which marks the half year mark for us doing this weekly podcast. So it's a pretty good time to recap some of our favorite episodes and some of our favorite questions with some of our favorite guests for those of you who maybe are just tuning in and have missed some of them. So, we're going to start off the show with a fermented cod liver oil rant that, you didn't have the pleasure of listening to a while ago because we just didn't have time to include it in the show. But you'll be happy to know that since this was recorded, I have fully converted Sarah to being a fermented cod liver oil lover. We also want to recommend that you check out our top five most downloaded shows. You might find that you enjoy episode 6, which is Weight Loss with Paleo. It's our most downloaded show by far. As you know, Sarah and I both lost a significant amount of weight with paleo, and we discuss our experiences and answer some questions on that with that show. We also have episode 9, which is Weight Loss Part 2. So evidently you guys love that topic, although you're not submitting a lot of questions on them. But then episode 17, which was our Paleo 101, we aired that before New Year's for our New Year's listeners. Episode 2, which is our very first autoimmune protocol show. And episode 11, What's Up with Dairy? So there you have it, top five shows, and prepare yourself for a little cod liver oil rant.
Cinnamon tingle, fermented cod liver oil, and...
Oh, I haven't gone there.
Sarah!
Oh, no, sorry. Can't do the fermented cod liver oil.
Have you tried it yet?
No, it sounds terrible. I'm scared.
Oh, I'm going to totally send you some. Everybody needs fermented cod liver oil. I personally was totally with you. Just the idea of it sounded awful to me. And I shared a house with Diane Sanfilippo and Liz Wolf of Balanced Bites and Haley Mason of Primal Palette when we went down to Paleo FX in February. And there were 3 or 4 bottles of fermented cod liver oil in the fridge because they were all taking it and felt like they couldn't even miss 5 days of taking it. So they like brought it with them to Texas. And so I was like, I feel that way about coconut oil because I use coconut oil.
Yeah. Oh, I travel everywhere with my Tropical Traditions Gold Label extra virgin coconut oil. Yes.
TSA raises their eyebrows at me and I say, don't even think about it. Like my coconut oil is staying with me. So, and they felt the same way about their fermented cod liver oil. And they're like, it's not bad. Just taste it. You know, it's, you know, whatever. And I'm like, you guys are full of it. You are just full of it. And there's a bunch of flavors. There's a chocolate flavor and an orange flavor. And,
That sounds vile.
Yeah,
sorry.
I know. I'm not going to.
Chocolate cod liver oil.
I'm not gonna recommend those. But supposedly kids really like those flavors. Anyway, the cinnamon tingle, what ends up happening is it's kind of like a fireball flavor. And so you literally get a little bit of that fireball burn to the point where it kind of like numbs your taste buds for a second.
Oh, great.
And you can't really taste the fish oily thing. And from having taken fish oil capsules previously, you know, you get those like nasty fish
burps. Fish oil burps?
Yeah. You don't get those with this. So okay, that's good. I took the liquid first. I bought a bottle of the liquid, which at my local store is $38 for a bottle, and it lasted me over 2 or 3 months, which is expensive. So just be forewarned when, if people go looking for this, but, I took 1 teaspoon in a shot glass of water and kind of shot it back. It actually tasted better, but I did get like 1 fish burp. It wasn't nasty, like a huge fish burp, because again, it has that fireball flavor, but, I did get a fish burp that way. So then my second time around, I was successfully talked into getting the gel, which, I don't like the texture because you have to put it on your tongue. You can't like put it in a shot glass and take it back the way that the other one could, but I don't get any fish burps at all from it. So that's going pretty well. And, I see Matt stealing it from me and he says it's not bad. So like if a dude is willing to eat it, like, you know, like, it's gotta be all right. Yeah, so you got to get you some of that. It'll totally help your skin too. It helps heal your gut. It's like amazing stuff. It's perfect for skin problems.
Yeah, and I mean I've heard amazing things about it, and I've read about it now on several blogs, and it sounds like pretty good stuff. I mean, I try and tell myself that the quality of meat that I'm eating and the amount of seafood that I'm eating, you know, should be enough. But then I, you know, 2 minutes later, I'll get frustrated and go, what am I not taking? All right. I guess I'll have to try it.
Yeah. If we talk again and you don't have it yet, it's going to show up on your doorstep, and then you're going to feel guilty. Cause I'll ask you every week, Sarah, how's the fish, the liver oil going? And you'll have to admit that.
I'm not sure if any stores around me sell it. I might have to get it online, but do have a,
it is available on greenpastures.org and on Amazon. I got it at a local, well, somewhat local place called For Goodness Sake, but it took me, I called every health store around before I found one, and that place was 45 minutes away. So, and also a lot of, farms and food co-ops sell it. So like for me, Sally Fallon's farm is an hour away, and we went up to her farm. Well, of course she's Sally Fallon, but when we went up to her farm to buy meat and eggs, she had it there for sale, and it was actually cheaper than it was at For Goodness Sake. And I think it was cheaper than it is on greenpastures.org, because she must get it like a wholesale price. So I mean, definitely look around and call around and see where you can get it, but it's not going to be cheap no matter where you find it. So because it's good quality stuff and it lasts a long time. Like you get what you pay for.
Well, and if it lasts a long time, then you can sort of think about it as, even though it's a big investment, it's not that much per day.
Per day. Exactly. Yeah. I would say the same thing about, deodorant, which is completely off topic,
but it's really not related to autoimmune protocol, but
I will tell you that switching to more natural beauty products, I think has helped also with, just general, body help, you know?
Yeah. Like, well, here's where I admit that one of the things I did to try and, help my body heal, because I was dealing with some scalp psoriasis, was I stopped washing my hair like 3.5 months ago.
I've heard that the no poo solution works well.
That's what I'm doing. I do nothing. I use some water.
Yeah. I no pooed for about 2 weeks, and then I poo pooed on the no poo. I saw
just barely see. That's the thing. You got to get through 3 weeks. Yeah, it's
you
like
have to remember I'm like in the corporate world, and I couldn't show up to work anymore looking like that. I couldn't do it.
You couldn't. I had lots of people say, just, you know, tie it up and do the messy bun look. Yeah. I have too short of hair to do that.
Yeah, me too.
There's a, what I did initially was use baking soda. This is like a total aside. Anyways, I used baking soda to get rid of some of the excess oil, and then used either vinegar or lemon juice as sort of a conditioner to sort of pH balance what the baking soda was doing. And as time has gone on, I've done a baking soda lemon juice wash less and less frequently. So initially, I think I made it about 2 weeks before I just had to do something because it was so gross. And then I kind of made it 3 weeks, then I made it four. I think it's been about 5 weeks now, and my hair seems to have sort of settled down, and figured that eventually I, you know, may only do that for special occasions.
Well, I've settled somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. I applaud you. And Liz Wolf from Cave Girl Eats and Haley Mason from Primal Palette are both no pooers, and they have the most beautiful, gorgeous, shiny hair. That's not what mine look like at all. So I settled somewhere in the middle and use a gluten-free, paraben-free, sulfate-free shampoo called Organics with an X. And it's okay for me right now. But I feel very passionately about my deodorant.
So, okay, so then since we're on this like crazy aside, which we may cut. I don't know if we're going to cut it. But since we're on this crazy aside, what deodorant do you use?
It's a brand called La Vanille. And I like the passion fruit. A lot of the natural deodorants that I've used, I've tried a lot of them. I ended up feeling like patchouli-ish halfway through the day. Even like the coconut baking soda. I, you know, if I had a dollar for every time someone told me, just use baking soda and coconut oil.
Dozens of comments with the, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little arrowroot powder thrown in, right?
I think it's wonderful for you if that works. I'm happy for you. It does not work for me. So the whole point of this, and maybe I'll get us back on track, is that the deodorant is not cheap at all. It's $18 for one stick of deodorant. However, I tell myself that it is worth 25 cents a day to not be stinky.
To not be stinky and potentially, you know, irritating your system further by applying chemicals that you're very likely oversensitive to.
Exactly. So when I'm sitting in a meeting and I can, you know, feel close being sardined into whatever and not feel like I'm going to, you know, be patchouli with my greasy hair and my stinky.
My hair is not greasy. My hair is gorgeous. I'm just throwing it
up. It was greasy for me. So that's all
you have to get through. It's like the adjustment period when you start paleo and you're craving all kinds of things. You have to get through it with your hair too.
Yeah. If it's something I'm personally dealing with, that's one thing. If it's something other people have to look at, that's
true.
Altogether. So anyway, I would say from just an overall perspective in the paleo, spear, that there are things that are individually more expensive, but then in the long run, to me, they're either worthwhile or I save money elsewhere. You know, I no longer use expensive moisturizers and cleansers. I just use coconut oil on my face now. So I think it's actually balanced out with upgrading shampoo and deodorant and then downgrading my facial care thing. So I think, you know, just for everybody,
That's a good argument for just about anything talking about food quality on paleo. I mean, there's areas that we spend a lot more money on, but then there's so many other areas where we save money.
Yeah.
And for our family, it's mostly balanced out.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
This clip is from a show that we did on dairy, episode 11. This is Sarah's Science with Sarah, and she's going to tell you what's up with the science on dairy and why we don't eat it, and a lot of people shouldn't be eating, especially processed dairy, or what to look out for into deciding whether or not dairy is something that you want to include on your ancestral diet.
So today for Science with Sarah, it just made the most sense to talk about what there is in dairy that is potentially problematic for people. And I just did a post on this that was called The Great Dairy Debate, because next to carbohydrate content, which, as you know, is very hotly debated with very diverse opinions in the paleo community, I think dairy is like the next big, like, hot debate topic, because you get people on the one side of the spectrum. You know, Professor Cordain really advocates no dairy whatsoever. He's not a fan of butter or heavy cream. You get the people who say, well, the fats in dairy are actually beneficial, so having some butter and some heavy cream, you know, sour cream is great. You get the next level up that say, well, fermented dairy gives you probiotics, so we should use fermented dairy. And then you get sort of the Weston A. Price Foundation primal philosophy that eating, you know, raw grass-fed dairy, however much of it that you want, is very, very healthful. And then people tend to have very strong opinions about whichever part of the spectrum they're on. So I'm a big fan of a lot of these issues. The reason why they're so hotly debated is because there's actually a huge amount of individuality in terms of how these foods are tolerated. So just like there's a huge amount of individuality in how much carbohydrates a person tolerates, there's a large amount of individuality in terms of how a person handles dairy. And that is because of the components of dairy that can be a problem for some people. So I know that Professor Cordain has an entire chapter dedicated to the issues with dairy in his book, The Paleo Answer, which I highly recommend for anyone. And also Chris Kresser has done a couple very, very good posts about the pros and cons of dairy and also the safety of raw dairy versus pasteurized dairy products. And I definitely recommend those posts. I'm sure Matt will put a link in the show notes. And I'm sorry, Matt, for making you do work to go look for those. But I just want to talk, to sort of highlight a couple of the really important points. So dairy contains lactose. Now, if you're eating raw dairy or low temperature vat pasteurized dairy, that milk also has enzymes that help you digest lactose. But if you're eating conventional dairy, there's lactose, but no enzymes to help you digest lactose. And lactose intolerance is incredibly prevalent. Something like 25% of Caucasians are lactose intolerant. But when you look at other ethnicities, the percentage is way higher. For example, like 97% of Native Americans are lactose intolerant. And so lactose intolerance could be a huge reason why people do not tolerate dairy, but why they might tolerate raw dairy. So that might put someone on the spectrum of, well, I don't eat any conventional dairy, but as long as I eat raw dairy, I'm fine. Milk also contains proteins that are highly allergenic. So we've already talked about casein, but whey is also allergenic. There's also casomorphin and butyrophilin, which are highly allergenic proteins. And you can get food sensitivity testing done to see if you have a reaction to any of those proteins. Those proteins are all also, it's really important to mention, cross-reactors for gluten. So if you have a gluten intolerance and your body is actually producing antibodies against gluten, which 20% of the population does, then you are likely to have your body recognize milk proteins as gluten. So those antibodies that your body forms against gluten happen to also recognize those milk proteins. So if you're gluten intolerant and the antibodies that your body produces against gluten cross-react with milk and you drink milk, your body thinks it's gluten. And that can be really problematic for people with gluten intolerance and people with celiac disease, which is why so many celiacs can't consume any dairy whatsoever. And if you have that kind of reaction to dairy, even consuming ghee can be really problematic, because even though ghee is 99.3% pure dairy fat, there's that 0.7% that is dairy proteins. And just like how celiacs can't eat a piece of fruit that touched the cutting board that the bread was cut on beforehand, even though it was, you know, wiped down briefly, even though those tiny bit of gluten exposure can make them incredibly ill, so can that tiny bit of dairy. There's other components in dairy that are worth, you know, a discussion about, you know, the pros and cons. So there's some links to components in dairy being linked to cancer. There's also some components of dairy that are potentially cancer preventatives. And so there's a lot more gray area in between. I think when we talk about dairy as a food, I think the most important thing to mention is that it is a food that a lot of people are intolerant to. And food intolerances can present as a really diverse symptoms. So you can have headaches and it's a food intolerance. You can have joint aches and it's a food intolerance. You can have, you know, skin conditions like eczema. You can make the symptoms of other diseases worse. Like maybe you have a hyperthyroidism or something like that, and it's, you know, linked to or triggered by food intolerance. So, you know, there's other places where you can go read my post on dairy or these other posts on dairy, and read some more about some of the other things that are a problem. But this is really kind of what the point that I wanted to drive home for this podcast is that a large number of people are either sensitive to lactose and they can't digest lactose, or have intolerance, which means their bodies are producing antibodies against the proteins in dairy. And the only way you really know, testing will get you fairly far, but the best way to know is to cut it out of your diet completely, 100%, for a month and see how you feel, and then try reintroducing small amounts, starting with something like ghee, then moving up to something like butter, then moving up to something like heavy cream, preferably grass-fed, then moving up to something like fermented dairy, and then moving up to, you know, other dairy, cheese, and straight milk. Do you want to add anything?
No, you got it. I think one of the things that's really missing in the community that I hear is the casein discussion. A lot of the people who find our site find it through going gluten-free, casein-free as a huge improvement in issues that their children are having. I think it's kind of finally being recognized by the medical community as something to try. And I think your kind of explanation of why that works in harmony and why, you know, taking it steps further with paleo is important and helpful. So,
yeah, and I guess when we talk about casein, it might be an important tidbit for some people, because I mentioned that I've reintroduced goat whey protein into my kids' diet, is that the casein in goats and sheep is actually a slightly different casein than the casein in cows. And that's why you often see people with allergies to cow's milk who can handle goat and sheep milk. And that's because the casein is slightly different. So just as a alternative to try for some people, if they're really missing some kind of dairy, there are ways that you can be intolerant to all dairy, but there are also ways you can be intolerant just to cow dairy.
I did, like, I don't remember where or when I saw it. Matt might know and be able to put in a link, but don't count on it. That said, actually, it might have been through Balance Bites. I don't remember. Anyway, that camel milk and horse milk are actually closer for us than cow's milk and goat's milk. Like, when you look at the casein and lactose structure, which was just fascinating to me, like, if you think about, like, camel and horse milk being mass-produced and available.
Awesome.
It's kind of funny. So.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm just picturing, I'm just picturing people with a bucket and a stool beneath a camel, and it's just wrong. I'm going to have nightmares tonight.
See, but like, that's the thing that I really want people to think about, as if you kind of stretch your boundaries of what dairy is, and you think, like, would you be perfectly okay with drinking camel milk if that's what it was, like, 100% replaced on the shelf, or do you have a mental block to that? Or another thing that really bothers people is thinking of children extended breastfeeding. Like, when you think of a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old breastfeeding, people get uncomfortable with that. I'm like, well, that's what you're doing when you're drinking cow's milk. Like, I want people to really think about that and be okay with that. And if you are, then that's totally your choice. But, you know, I feel like once I finally understood that that was the breast milk of another species, then it made me a lot more okay with being able to give that up, because I, like everybody else, enjoy dairy. Don't get me wrong. Like, I miss cheese and I really miss ice cream and everything in between. And so, like, I know that it's hard and there's an opiate response in your brain when you eat that stuff. And there's a reason for that, because as a nursing baby, like, you, the baby is encouraged to drink the breast milk of whatever species because it's giving them an opiate response, and you're giving yourself that same opiate response when you drink the breast milk of other creatures. And so if you're okay with that, or if you're moderating, or if you recognize that there are benefits to eating, you know, fermented, pastured, raw, whatever your source is, and you don't have issues with it, then, like, by all means, I'm not judging you, go for it. I wish I could do it. But if you can't, then, like, just tell yourself why you can't, and you'll feel better about it. Yeah?
Yeah.
I have a lot of soapbox on this topic, and we have like 13 minutes to effectively finish the show.
I don't think we're going to keep this one to an hour. But I got an excellent tweet about last week's episode that says, not only was it not too long, but it totally rocked. So I guess the standard is, like,
just do it.
2 hours is okay.
Yeah. I don't, I like to go to bed before that, but yeah,
I just have to go to bed. So it can't be 2 hours, because otherwise I'll be a wreck.
And
tomorrow.
If you're listening to this early Friday morning, recognize that we're recording this late many days before. So.
Yes. Because we have to wait for the kids to go to bed for it to be quiet enough in the background.
And then Matt has
to let's move on to questions and answers.
Yes. Go for it. Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope.
Okay, our favorite questions. This is episode number 8 with Diane Sanfilippo, author of Practical Paleo, and she helps us answer the question, what can you do to heal when you've actually consumed food that makes you sick? Obviously, we chose this. It's a little on topic, as yesterday was Valentine's Day. Hopefully you made good choices, but if not, maybe this will help you recover.
One last question, and this is, I think, one that could be an entire podcast topic. So let's just keep sort of a brief answer to this one. But it is for when it happens that you eat something, whether it's gluten or something else that you're sensitive to, that is really making you feel unwell, what can you do to heal and get over it as quickly as possible?
So, first of all, when people kind of go off the rails or get an exposure, whether they know about it or not, not like beating themselves up for it mentally for a while is usually a good first step. In terms of healing, it's like, get right back to eating good foods, you know, get right back to your normal programming, so to speak. Doing stuff like adding in some extra bone broth for gut healing. L-glutamine is also a really useful amino acid supplement that can be helpful for gut healing. And it really depends on what kind of symptoms you have, what ends up happening. Is it gut irritation, or is it that, you know, you experience other side effects? You know, if it's like skin issues, maybe you need to make sure you're getting some more sun or getting some more vitamin D, or you're getting the, you know, we always recommend like a fermented cod liver oil, getting your vitamin A and D from that and making sure that your nutrient sufficiency is really there. Other than that, I don't really have like a huge list of kind of how to come back from it. I just think it's really important to be aware of how you react to different things, you know, and like what Stacey said earlier, how it affects her mood. I get brain fog really easily. Like if I do gluten-free pancakes, I just feel like a zombie, you know? So I just know, okay, be aware of that and kind of don't feed into it, you know? So if you're feeling ill, I know a lot of people kind of, they get off track and then they go back to these like old comfort foods of, you know, saltine crackers and chicken soup from a can. And I'm like, that is not going to help anybody's body. Right? I told you to eat chicken soup. She did not mean from a can. She meant from a chicken that you cook. Right? You know, it's just like, recognize it, have that mindfulness about it. Don't beat yourself up, but just have the mindfulness to know, even if it's like a sugar bender, you know, just know that like if you keep feeding into it, it'll keep growing. That beast will keep growing. So I don't have this happen too often outside of, I guess, sugar benders are really the worst for me, where it's like too much chocolate or too much mango. I don't really notice anything. Like I don't think I get exposures. If I do, I don't feel them too strongly. And that's really the only advice I give to people who are dealing with it. I don't really have too much else. I know there are some sort of like, I don't really know a better way of putting this, but it's almost like the equivalent of like a morning after pill. I mean, cut that out if you want to.
No, it's, I think they do. They have
time. You can get them from possibly places like Whole Foods or wherever they sell supplements at a co-op or something. I know that there are practitioner lines that make them, and also Amazon.com might have some, but they're not really like, it's not like I can eat gluten and then just take this and I'm fine. It's just more if you're having a severe reaction, it might be helpful.
Yeah, don't go out and get Cinnabons and pizza and then take that and think everything will be okay.
Not how it works.
Yeah, I would say, Diane, I do all the things that you talked about. In fact, I do bone broth at every meal, and I try to almost fast on nothing but fat and bone broth. So that seems to really help my body. I don't, you know, everybody has their own thing. Like for somebody else, maybe eating a lot of carbs might help. I don't know. But I know for me personally, sticking to really high fat foods. So like coconut milk, or I do bacon a lot when I know bacon's like my cure all. It's my morning after gluten pill. And I do bone broth as often as I can. So fortunately for me, we almost always have bone broth around. Like Matt makes huge batches and then we freeze it. So, you know, I'm able to just kind of thaw broth and then sip on it. Or I used to really like egg drop soup. I can't do it anymore, but egg drop soup for breakfast was one of my favorite things, and then just kind of having broth or soup throughout the rest of the day. I like to introduce other probiotic foods as well. So you know, if you don't like sauerkraut or fermented food, kombucha is another thing that I do. And I really like licorice root tea or herbal teas, whatever you enjoy drinking, I think are helpful and soothing on the digestive tract. Ginger and honey, like if you have a ginger, like a genuine ginger tea, not a fake ginger tea, but if you find tea with real ginger in it, or you can make your own. I think, I'm pretty sure it's Alana's Pantry has a ginger root tea, and you use local or good quality honey that can be really soothing and helpful in the digestive tract. Anything else I'm forgetting?
Yeah, sleep.
Sleep. Sleep. Oh, good one. Yeah.
Sleep. You know, do whatever you can to get sleep so your body can heal, because that is the, you know, nutrition is essential, but so is sleep. You need to rest. And, you know, for me, that always means going to bed early, because I don't have control over what time I get up. And I have to get up at the same time when my kids get up every morning, no matter what. So even if I'm just stressed or feeling run down, it doesn't even have to be that I ate something that I shouldn't have. It can be sort of any life issues that are, you know, getting to me physically. I just try and go to bed an hour early, hour and a half early. I have nights where I go to bed at 8 o'clock just so that I can get that extra couple hours sleep. And that makes all the difference for me.
Yeah. And I would say too, something that we haven't mentioned is, I think Diane, you kind of mentioned it, is, you know, yeah, don't give into it in terms of like going on a bender, but also don't give into it if you're having mood issues that you're aware of. You know, I've found that now that I know if I have a gluten exposure that I become like this crazy Hulk lady, I'm able to kind of rationally say to Matt, you know, I think I got glutened and I'm really sorry. I'm just going to be a jerk for the next couple of days. And then I just try to really not be a jerk.
You know what though? That is the awesomest excuse ever. So yeah, that's useful. I'm going to have that one. I'm acting this way because I accidentally ate some gluten. Yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like it's kind of an out of body experience. You know, like I can see myself behaving in ways that are completely non-normal, and I can feel myself saying and doing things that I don't want to say. And so over time I've learned that, like, if I just pull back a little and let just the voices in my head yell at Matt for something that he doesn't deserve to be yelled at for, then I feel like my time of the problem is shorter because I'm really working on, like, not accepting the meltdown. And so then my body doesn't go into like full meltdown mode, and then it's a harder hole to climb out of. So if you experience some sort of emotional problem, or like Sarah, you were saying low energy, like if you're experiencing some sort of mental thing like that, try to really fight it as best you can. Obviously sleep and good food help you fight it, but also really kind of mental relaxation, de-stress, listen to calm music, do whatever you can to kind of pull yourself out of that deep hole, because I find that it makes the recovery time quicker.
I think I'm like used to giving this whole protocol about how to heal things like leaky gut or digestive issues so often that I like forget to relist out everything, but I think you guys covered most everything. But I can't believe
you forgot sauerkraut.
That's an issue though that somebody's having. Like, I would recommend re-inoculating the gut if something you ate gave you diarrhea and you basically had like an everybody out moment where your whole like large intestine cleared out so quickly that it took the good and the bad with it. But this is stuff that I, you know, some of the more quote unquote proprietary guides in my book that won't ever be for free on the website. Like, I put all the food guides for free on my website because there's stuff that I had on the site before. They've just been updated and revised for the book. But Guide to Digestion, Guide to Healing a Leaky Gut, that stuff, those are in the book, and, you know, tons of details in there. But I think it just really depends on what somebody's dealing with, you know,
And I know, you know, Sarah and I mention your book often. We're not spokespeople. We're not getting, you know, some sort of percentage. But I feel really connected to your book because it's the first one that fully addressed beyond paleo, in my opinion. You know, and I feel like that's really the next key to everybody getting healthy, is figuring out what their triggers are and what conditions they might have that paleo helped, but also, okay, now what's next? You know, like,
go ahead. So, like, it's the nature of, like, I always say this when I introduce my background and myself and in workshops to people, it's like, I don't come from paleo. Like, I came into paleo, but I come from a holistic nutrition education background. So I learned all this stuff just about how food works and how, you know, different conditions affect the body. And, you know, then I happened to learn about paleo, and and discovered that, you know, all the things I had already learned were maybe made even better with this approach. So, you know, what I learned about how to help people wasn't like, don't eat these foods and it will cure all your problems, because that's not how it works. You know, it's fortunate that what paleo does is it takes you through the first step of a gut healing protocol, because it removes problematic foods, but it doesn't end there. The healing doesn't end there. So you guys are, I'm sure you cover a lot of this. We talked about a lot of it today, but like, you have to repair, re-inoculate the gut, and then look to reintroduce foods and see how you feel if you want to, or like what we've been talking about today, if you inadvertently reintroduce a food and see how that works, you know? So I think it's a complex thing, but everybody's got their own journey, and they can kind of figure out, you know, how they're going to handle things like dining out and food on the go, but also healing. You know, everyone's got a little bit of a different process that works for them.
Yep. Each one of my kids is very different as well. So I think, like, you know, everybody's unique, and especially in the family dynamic, figuring out, you know, kind of what you're going to do as a whole unit, what some people's rules might be different than other people's rules, and all that kind of stuff. And that it evolves. You know, Sarah and I both didn't realize we have autoimmune conditions until we were later in life. So, you know, if you start paleo, I know for me, I started paleo, everything was great the first year. And then I started realizing that I had other health issues that I wanted to address, that my hair was falling out and my nails were weak, and okay, what do I need to do about that? You know, those things were not even on my radar when I was 336 pounds and terrible joint pain and I couldn't walk, you know, like I wasn't concerned with the other things that I had going on. So I think, you know, we talk a lot, and everybody needs to talk more about how it's an evolving process, and everybody should really be looking at what they have in their own life and in their own bodies, and how can they improve that? Because if the goal is health, then we should all be striving always to achieve better health. And was on our episode 14 show, which was Practical Paleo Part 2. We actually had Michelle from Nom Nom Paleo on, and this is by far, I think, Sarah and I's favorite question that we've ever answered, mostly because it will definitely make you laugh. Here, Sarah, Michelle, and I answer some tips on freezing food and food safety, and it results in, you know, some giggles.
Question 3 is from Amy from Raleigh, North Carolina. And she writes, we've been paleo for 10 months off and on, but strictly paleo for the last 4 weeks as my daughter's on an elimination diet, which pretty much follows the paleo autoimmune protocol. Speaking of which, we have 2 more weeks before reintroducing dairy, gluten, and nightshades one at a time. This is more of a request than a question. Could you provide tips on freezing food and food safety? Thanks for all you do. Your podcasts and websites have helped us more than you could know. Her question isn't really related to her background. She wants tips on freezing food and food safety.
Okay. I would just want to take a moment to encourage her to maybe not reintroduce gluten.
Yeah, that's kind of hard to let that one slide.
So, Amy, if your daughter's, you know, had a need to go on an elimination diet, probably look into a lot of the sciencey stuff Sarah has posted on, or in Practical Paleo by Diane Sanfilippo, about how gluten can destroy all the progress that you might have made on this elimination diet by adding it back in. So I have been on a similar autoimmune protocol, and I would say that dairy and nightshades are something that I don't think would nearly fall into the same category in terms of adding it back in and seeing how you respond. But with gluten, I would try not to ever purposely eat that if you can avoid it. So, okay, that said, are we good to answer
the question? We're good. Yeah, no, that you said exactly what I was going to say, so I don't need to say it again.
Okay. So, I don't know. I don't really do a lot of food freezing. I thought your idea earlier about doing Ziploc baggies and squeezing air out with a straw was really smart. I usually close like 9/10 of the bag and then kind of push down on it to get the air out. Cause we don't have a vacuum sealer. We do have some special containers that we bought that were made for food storage in the freezer for when we do meal storage. And, our popular frozen meal that we make in this house is, our recipe for Fool's Gold, which is just chicken nuggets. We freeze trays of that so that people who babysit the kids have something quick and easy, that we can pull out of the freezer before they come over, and they have something that we know the kids will eat that's easy for them to cook. But other than that, we don't really do a lot of food freezing, so I don't have many tips.
So for me, I actually freeze a lot of stews, and I freeze a lot of, well, since I sous vide, I have a lot of pre-cooked meats that have been cooked, vacuum sealed, that I stick in the freezer, and then they're, you know, kind of ready to just reheat in my sous vide oven, which is like a temperature controlled water oven. So I do have that stuff frozen. I also freeze a lot of my bones that I have. Like if I've roasted chicken, I'll keep the carcass. And because you need, you know, quite a few bones to make bone broth, I just accumulate bones in the freezer.
And I do that too.
And then, yeah, and then when, you know, there's enough bones to make bone broth, then I make a pot of bone broth. There are certain vegetables I really like to freeze. Like ginger is something that I always keep in the freezer because you can, you know, I like to microplane frozen ginger, and it's perfect. Like a lot of times ginger can go bad really quickly in the fridge, but it keeps forever in the freezer, and it microplanes really, it becomes kind of this kind of snow ginger that melts into all of your dishes and gives it a little bit of ginger without like the stringy, spicy ginger that a lot of people don't like. So that's, and I actually keep a lot of frozen vegetables. Like I'm part of a CSA, and I do try to go to the farmer's market, but when I don't have any time, I will just, you know, grab a bag of frozen veggies and, you know, use that for the vegetable side, either for breakfast or dinner, because it's already prepped and it's quick.
Yeah, I always have. I really like Trader Joe's for frozen vegetables, and I always have bags of broccoli and green beans and artichoke hearts and sometimes asparagus, and just for when I get to a meal, usually late in the week, you know, the day before I go to the farmer's market. I can be like, oh, okay, we need another vegetable, and I'll just pull out some broccoli. It works.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things you just, it's hard for like a regular consumer to just freeze vegetables because you can't like individually quick freeze it without it ruining the texture. So I just buy it frozen. Like whenever there's a sale at the grocery store, I just stock up on my favorite combinations.
So, Sarah, science question. I've heard before that the flash frozen vegetables are actually going to have a higher vitamin and mineral content than any other form of vegetable except fresh, i.e.
Like canned or canned?
Yeah.
That's the only other
option there would be, but I guess maybe you can buy them like parboiled in the produce section sometimes. Like basically, can you validate that flash frozen vegetables retain their vitamin and mineral content to kind of give a scientific background on the fact that just because it's coming frozen from a store doesn't mean that it's necessarily a bad product?
Yeah, actually, frozen vegetables often will have higher vitamin content than even fresh vegetables, if you're talking about fresh vegetables in a grocery store, because they are they're frozen really quickly, so that the vitamins and, you know, the all of the other polyphenols and every other good stuff doesn't degrade, and they're picked at the peak of freshness, whereas a lot of the things that you get in a grocery store is picked before it's ripe, and it ripens as it travels, and they're sort of you know, designed to sort of sit around. And as they sit, that's when a lot of those compounds will degrade. The obviously the best is to be getting, you know, farm fresh produce from the farmer's market that was picked that morning and is organic and grown in really good quality dirt. So you're getting all of the trace minerals and the good soil-based microorganisms that are still in your food. And I mean, that's the ideal situation, but there's like absolutely nothing wrong with frozen vegetables. They can be incredibly healthy and they can be really cheap and convenient too. So definitely they're a good way to go. Canned is different because those often have to be, they're cooked before they're canned, and then you lose vitamins into the cooking liquid, which isn't necessarily all put in the can. And then the cans can have chemicals like BPA in them, which can leach into your food. So there's a lot more. I mean, canned food is still, you know, when you're talking about fruits and vegetables, there's still some nutritional value, but it's certainly not as high as any other way you can get that food. And there's a lot more things to consider when we're picking them.
Thank you.
I wanted to just, you know, because we've sort of talking about frozen food, and we've talked a little bit about food safety with frozen food, but maybe we could just quickly talk about some sort of more general food safety issues. Like for me, I give everything 5 days. So if I cook meat, like leftovers have to be consumed within 5 days. And that's sort of my length of time before I go, okay, it's now we're starting to risk poisoning ourselves. And it gets, if there's any leftovers left at that point, it gets composted typically. What about, do we have any other sort of like general food safety tips? I am like a crazy germ Nazi when it comes to handling raw chicken in my house. I like pull out all the cleaners, and I keep a clean, like a disinfectant cloth on the tap of the kitchen sink and on the soap pump so that I can even like turn on the sink and wash my hands without touching anything. I'm like, just with raw chicken, I don't get freaked out about other raw meats, but with raw chicken, I become like totally OCD. It's kind of freaky.
We're the opposite in this family. It's pretty funny. Bill and Haley were here a couple of weeks ago, and they asked us which cutting board was for meat and which was for vegetables. And Matt and I looked at each other and we're like, all of them, which I know is not recommended. So I would say one of the tips I can recommend is that if you are worried about food safety and food prep, you know, designate space in your kitchen, whether that be separate cutting boards or separate counters or whatever it is, to prep your raw meat from your either cooked meat or your vegetables. That way, if there are germs, you're not transferring it. You know, we buy really high quality meat locally from good sources, so we just are not as concerned as if we were buying kind of store-bought brand that might have more cause for concern in terms of bacteria and disease. But I thought I had one more idea about food safety, but oh, I was going to also say we used to use the Clorox wipes in our kitchen all the time. And about 2 years ago, we switched to the seventh generation, and we really like those for when you're done with raw meat, or if you have a spill or, you know, whatever it is, we use those as kind of our disinfectant wipe up. And they're not the most environmentally sound, but they are a good alternative to what we were using and what we had gotten used to. So
I mean, I actually don't think Sarah is crazy, because I was a food science major back in college. So, I mean, I think it's important to have a lot of, you know, to be somewhat vigilant food handling.
Thank you.
Totally. And I have this thing where nobody can, you know, stick a spoon that they've stuck in their mouth, like no double dipping ever, because then you get all sorts of badness in your food that can grow.
But Mythbusters, I love
the technical term of badness.
Mythbusters totally said that that's not true. I watched it with Cole.
I saw that episode too.
I don't know. In my, you know, in my food science classes, they were saying that, you know, Staph aureus can cause badness. So I don't know that I want to.
All right. I'll tell Cole that your badness trumps his favorite show.
But do you remember that Mythbusters episode and just like total shout out to Mythbusters because it's like a sorry, but like Adam and Jamie are my heroes.
It's a show everybody should be watching.
Yeah, it's awesome. In that episode, this is so geeky of me. Oh my goodness. Okay. They were actually testing like whether double dipping was the same as putting a whole pile in your mouth and then spitting into it. Like that was the actual myth they were testing. So they were actually finding that if you put a whole pile of like the dip in your mouth and then spit it back into the bowl, that had more germs than if you double dip.
But I think it's where, I mean, if you, let's say you double dip and then it's in your fridge for say a few days, then
where something can grow.
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, I just don't want to potentially introduce anything that could grow. And I mean, like when we redid our kitchen, like we made sure that like I wanted like a stainless countertop to do my food prep just so cleanup would be easy and we could, you know, disinfect it and stuff, you know, when we had to. So I do think, I mean, and by having good food handling, then you have leftovers that you can eat, you know, you're more comfortable about eating your leftovers if it's been a few days. And so I mean, I think that's just something that I try to do.
Yeah. Now there's also, like I, you know, way like 20 years ago took a food safety class. Cause my first two part-time jobs when I was growing up were in kitchens.
I love how embarrassed you guys are of this. It's adorable. Like, your geekiness is what's charming. Don't be embarrassed.
But there's all different kinds of rules about how long a food can stay out at room temperature or can be, you know, just sort of kept on a warming element on the stove versus, you know, simmering away on the stove or in the fridge. So there are, like generally if you think of body temperature as being like a really comfortable temperature for microorganisms to grow, if your food is kept like just kind of warm and not hot enough to kill things and not cold enough to slow growth, that's like where you want to be really careful about how long your food's at that temperature. So when you're putting leftovers in the fridge, you want them to cool down as quickly as possible. So whatever you can do, you know, leave the lid off the container until it's cold or put it in smaller containers so it cools down faster. Those are things that you want your food to, you know, basically either be cold or hot. And that happy, lukewarm body temperature type temperature is a really bad temperature to keep food at for any length of time. Have we exhausted the food safety tips?
I just want to let people know that if this is not something that you're paying attention to, and that you're, you know, reasonably washing your hands after you touch raw meat and you're, you know, using good quality meat, that You're not alone. I'm with you. So, fist pump.
But you know, I do think if there's like, if you've had, you know, food out and it's like you're having people over and you're having this buffet and there's just been food out for hours, I don't think it's always a great idea to just stick them in the fridge and eat them the next day. Unless you're going to heat them up again. Like, I think, say, a turkey that's been out for like, you know, 8 hours, which is conceivable with like a Thanksgiving turkey, I think you should pack your leftovers pretty quickly. Like, is my own personal bias. But I know I'm probably being crazy.
You don't sound crazy to me, though.
I'll eat the leftovers. And that's why I'm probably sick. All right. Episode 10 was our beauty products and environmental hazards and toxins show, where we had Liz Wolf from Cave Girl Eats and Haley Mason from The Food Lovers Primal Palette, who is actually a registered esthetician, if I've got that correctly, on to discuss our
take on natural beauty. And this question, what natural beauty products are you using, helped us all find beauty products that we each individually like and support, and will hopefully get you away from some of the products that you use that might not be ideal. So, good luck not smelling like a stinky hippie. From Christine in Nampa, Idaho. It's my turn to hope that I didn't just offend a city in
Idaho. So it's not just me.
No, it's not. So Christine says, I have searched the web for info on personal care products that are beyond natural, something someone on paleo would use. No one ever talks about this topic, and I feel it is a very important one to address. I am allergic to so many shampoos, conditioners, soaps, toothpaste, etc. It's crazy. Please share what products you ladies are using. Well, Christine, I'm happy to tell you that there are people talking about it, and they're on this call. So I know that Liz is the resident expert, and all four of us have our own varying levels of how far we're going with this. Yeah. So hopefully we'll get some good answers. Liz, you want to start?
Yeah, I'm just sitting here, you know, like with incense going, sitting on a pile of like, I don't know, like patchouli, something. I'm total hippie about this
stuff. Don't even make out. I've hugged you and you smell fresh and you look nice.
Oh, man. Like I said before, good thing we're not on video chat right now. All right. So here is – there are just so many awesome, just freeing ways to just liberate yourself from all this ridiculous personal care crap that we've been sold since day one. I get mad about it now because for the longest time I dealt with eczema, skin irritation, just raw, easily cracked skin – so many irritations thinking I was using, you know, this really gentle stuff, or it was supposed to be non-comedogenic, which FYI, all that means is doesn't cause comedones, like doesn't cause zits. So I guess if something was comedogenic, we would have a huge problem. But so there are a ton of things that you can do. You can Google for just cleansing your face. You can Google the oil cleansing method. Primal Life Organics has some amazing stuff if you don't want to kind of do it yourself, make your own goodies. As far as toothpaste goes, you can make your own. There's also a great clay-based remineralizing toothpaste. I think that Wellness Mama talks about. Primal Life Organics has one as well. I personally brush with the essential oil blend from Aura Wellness, which I just love. As far as hair goes, I personally do the no poo method, which is not what it sounds like. It actually is basically just using baking soda and apple cider vinegar to cleanse your hair. That's pretty much what's in my shower, is a giant tub of apple cider vinegar and a big mason jar full of baking soda. That doesn't work for everyone, though. That does kind of depend on the mineral content of your water. So you can try that, give yourself a couple weeks to adjust if it doesn't work out. You could just order basic gluten-free. And yes, some personal care products do have gluten, which while it can't be, I guess, absorbed or transported across the skin, if you have like an open sore wound or anything that most of us with sensitive skin throughout our lives have had, it can be a problem. Legitimately. So gfsoap.com is great. Lye soap from Grandma's Lye Soap is great. Dr. Bronner's is great for Castile soap. I could talk all day. I do have a skincare nutrition guide coming out pretty soon, or not a nutrition guide, but a skincare guide. We're going to talk about how to support digestion so your skin gets everything it needs and all the different things you can do topically with your hair, with your armpits, all that good stuff to keep it really natural and as few ingredients as possible. I'll stop talking now. I could say more, but
wait, what's your favorite deodorant? Cause I am still trying to find a deodorant that actually works.
My favorite deodorant. I've had the most success with just doing some coconut oil and some baking soda dabbed on top of that. But to be honest, that is almost a little bit abrasive for that area of my body. I've used one from, I have it right here, one from Wilderness Family Naturals that does not have baking soda in it, and that's been all right. It smells good. Primal Life Organics has a really good pit stick. And I just got in the mail something called Primal Pit Paste that I have not tried yet. I think with the deodorant stuff, as far as deodorant goes, like baking soda will do it. There's nothing that's going to stop your girl from sweating. I mean, that's just going to happen.
Well, that's a natural thing. Something to stop you from sweating. I think that's what a lot of people are getting is that, you know, if you're using an antiperspirant, it's aluminum going into your pores. And whether or not, you know, that's scientifically proven to be good or not good, it just doesn't sound like a good idea to me. So I will say I tried coconut oil and baking soda. It did not work for me. I just did not feel fresh. I work in an office. Like, I think it's important for me to feel clean and womanly and like I can work late and have a meeting and not be stinky at the end of the day. And I've tried a bunch of deodorants, some of the ones you listed, Liz, as well as some of the store-bought brands like Salt Sticks and Tom's and stuff like that. Even the Tropical Traditions brands. Some of those are okay, but by the end of the day or if I'm working out, they just don't work for me. I have found a brand that's not like, you know, uber natural, but it is much more safe for your skin, and that's La Vanille brand. It's I only like the passion fruit vanilla flavor. It's the only one that makes me feel like I'm not a hippie. It smells very fresh, and I personally really like it. It's not cheap though. Most of these things that we're going to be talking about, you know, you get what you pay for. So,
right,
Haley, what do you use
for deodorant?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Like roses all the time.
I know she does.
Prettiest
no,
girl.
I really don't. I don't. I can promise you that. I do the coconut oil and the baking soda thing. And then I found a salt spray at Whole Foods. Can't remember what it's called. But it's really great. And it actually works a lot better than I thought. I think I've had the most success with the salt spray. And I started using that because Diane told me she was using one. I guess her trainer, one of her friends who will train with her on some like mobility stuff. They were working out, and he was like, "Diane, you got to get some salt spray." So I started using that because of her, and I actually really, really like it. I was doing the no poo thing for a while. Like I said, I basically just copied everything that Liz did. It sounded really interesting for me. My background is actually a high definition makeup artist and an esthetician. I was trained in Los Angeles to do makeup for print and television. And then after that, I went to New York and I shadowed a medical esthetician, in a medical spa and worked with her. And when I was living in LA, I was 18 and I was in school for makeup and I was taking on all this crap, MAC, you name it. And then I was in LA, which, you know, the pollution there is pretty bad. So my skin was a wreck and nothing really seemed to fix it. And it wasn't like I had cystic acne. It was just like, if you got up close to me, you would see my skin, especially on my cheeks, was really uneven. And like, I had little bumps everywhere. And, if I would like extract myself, these little like waxy things would come out. And, so that was kind of my problem forever. And I thought I had to use all this really abrasive, harsh products on my skin. And, you know, then working in a medical spa, I was, you know, using a bunch of really intense products on my skin. I was like, I need to dry myself out. I need to do peels. I did like salicylic acid. And then after I'd been working in a spa here in Pittsburgh for a while doing skincare, I went to a medical spa and I got a really intense chemical peel and nothing ever really seemed to work. And the only thing that kind of came out of it was more flare-ups with rosacea on my cheeks. So what I ended up realizing was that my skin was actually really sensitive and I was breaking out because I was overly drying my skin, which was causing my skin to overcompensate, which was making me break out. So what I actually needed to do was kind of back off the really intense
products and drying out my skin and add in some good hydration. But whenever I was in New York working with the medical esthetician, they had me using Jane Iredale mineral makeup. And I know, Liz, you said you're not so sure about it. I've always had really great experiences with it. I've never known anyone to react badly to it. I use it on my face. Every time I do my makeup, I've used it for years, and my skin reacts.
You used it on me for that, the book cover shoot, and right. I was fine with it. I think maybe I had some kind of bad batch way back in the day, so totally would default to your recommendations on that, Haley.
So the Iredale, the Jane Iredale, that was designed for doctors to prescribe to women who had like laser resurfacing, really intense procedures on their skin where they needed sun protection and they also wanted to feel normal outside. And Iredale will cover everything. You can have laser resurfacing done on your face or a really intense peel, and the Iredale will cover it and you wouldn't even know. And it acts as a barrier on your skin to protect it from airborne pollutants. And it has natural sun protection in it. I think most of them are SPF 20. So I really love it. I would put it on women after waxing them and they would be covered up and I wouldn't worry that it would make them break out. And it also photographs really, really well. Most mineral makeups do not photograph well. And I use Iredale on all brides that I do for weddings, and anyone that I use it on Diane for her book cover. I use it on Liz. I use it on myself for any time I'm being photographed, and it just makes your skin look really, really nice. So, that's my recommendation for makeup. That's the line that I know the best, and I've had a lot of really good experience with it, and I've never seen any adverse, effects to it. And I've used it on a lot of people. And then as far as the skincare, like I said, I was doing tons of really intense stuff to my skin for years, being, you know, an esthetician and really being into medical skincare and wanting, you know, to learn more about laser and chemical peels and all that stuff. It all seemed really interesting to me. And then I started doing the oil cleansing method because of Liz, and I found out the oil that works best for me. I did the blend for a while, but now I just use coconut oil. And every night I wash my face with coconut oil. I massage the coconut oil into my face and make sure I remove all of my makeup with it. And then I rinse a washcloth under warm water and wring it out and then kind of steam my face with it and then wipe it all off. And it's really interesting because I used to feel like I had to scrub my face with cleanser every morning and every night. And now that I've been doing the oil cleansing method, just water every now and then is fine on my skin. And then also because of Liz, I started using the Green Pastures Beauty Balm and I sleep in that every night and my skin has never looked better. So coconut oil, a paleo diet, and Green Pastures Beauty Balm are my skin protocols, and my rosacea has gone away and I don't break out and my skin is amazing. I've never been happier with my skin.
I'm doing the same coconut oil beauty balm. I do a bit of a exfoliation with a washcloth and just hot water, kind of like you said, you steam. I kind of scrub a little bit to exfoliate, but I'm doing basically the exact same thing you said, Haley, and yeah. It's doing a lot better. And I have found that switching makeup brands, although I'm using Bare Minerals, so it sounds like I need to switch my brand of mineral makeup, but I found that using that also improves my skin condition from some of the heavier brands that I was using before.
Yeah. Well, I can hook you up with the Iredale, Stacey. Don't worry.
All right. I'm happy
hey,
to have the hookup.
What about me?
I'll send you some deodorant, Sarah.
Oh, sweet.
You need the lavanil.
I've also switched to just using coconut oil as a cleanser, a moisturizer. I even use a coconut oil-based hand soaps now in the house, and I'm using a coconut oil-based soap for shaving my legs because
You need something slippery to shave your legs.
Yep.
And that's working really, really well for me. I'm trying to really work on reducing my exposure to chemicals right now as part of my ongoing experimentation with what I can do to cure my autoimmune disease. And I have been no poo for almost 6 months. Was the last time shampoo touched my head. And as time goes on, I'm now going, I think it's been probably a month and a half since I've even used baking soda and vinegar. I'm using basically water or nothing. And as time goes on, my hair is continuing to adjust and it's just looking shinier and softer and less messy. I have kind of a just curly enough to be annoying hair, so it just basically looks messy all the time. And when
you curly-haired girls don't appreciate what you've got.
Yes, I do.
I have to say I totally do because I had straight hair until my first pregnancy. And then I had wavy hair. And then with my second pregnancy, it went as curly as it is now. So I had straight hair for 30 years. I did straight hair and always coveted curly hair. And so now I enjoy it. But it's not looking, it doesn't look as messy anymore. It's just smoother and sleeker and, it doesn't have, like at first it would sort of, it had not a greasy feel, but like a lanolin feel, kind of like pet hair. That sounds terrible to think of pet hair
kind
on your head.
Kind of waxy maybe a little?
Yeah, just slightly. I mean, it just like, it was kind of like petting a soft dog. And now it just feels really smooth and soft. So as you know, it's taken a lot of patience. I mean, I don't work in an office, so there's basically just the people who see me at yoga class 3 times a week who have to deal with how slimy my hair is. But, as time has gone on, it's gotten nicer, nicer, nicer. So it's been like a really interesting experience in giving up chemicals. And the reason why I did that was because I basically ran out of shampoos that didn't cause my scalp to turn beet red and burn and then have all my skin peel off like a sunburn. And I had gone through, you know, prescription shampoos, through all of the various natural chemical-free ones, gluten-free ones. I'd sort of gotten through, you know, I tried them all. And when I started to get allergic to the last one, I went, okay, I need something else. And I decided that my something else would be nothing. So, but I still feel like I'm still experimenting with other, you know, skincare and, you know, deodorants and other sort of products to try and figure out what works, but that
also
doesn't
have the way to tackle it. I mean, there is no, it's the same way with food. People think they have to have it all figured out right now and they have to know all of the things and they have to do all of the things right. And it's just like, we're all just leaning in the right direction. You know, when I see my mother-in-law, you better be dang well sure that I'm using some aluminum deodorant and it's all, you know, it's all bets are off when I'm going to see the mother-in-law. So
I'm going to send you some Lavanil. You're going to really like it as your special deodorant, Liz.
Oh, I'm excited. I need special deodorant.
I need to send you something anyway. So now I'm getting beauty ideas. So I totally use store-bought shampoo and, kind of without shame at this point, cause I really tried to go no poo. I even did it over a 2-week period of vacation where I was away from work and had hoped that like by the time I went back to work, I would be over the hump, and it was just awful. It was really,
you'd give it a what? You were over the what? Did you say over the hump or you'd give it a hump?
No, it's over the hump. I was,
oh my gosh.
There's
there was
a period of like worsening with that.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And just so everyone knows, if you do no poo, like you're doing it right if it gets worse before it gets better.
Yes. And headbands, many headbands and hats. Yes.
And if your hair is long and you can wear it up in a bun or you can wear a hat or a headband or whatever your scarf strategy is, like go for it. But for me, I just could not get there. It was too much for me. So,
I did it with short hair. Like I actually got my hair cut shorter than normal in order to do it.
Yeah.
And now that my hair is changed texture so much, I'm thinking about growing it longer again. So,
well, my hair is curly, like very curly. So the first 6 inches being oily was very heavy. So it was like straight oil segment and then curls after. It looked like a bad perm in the 80s gone. It was just not a good thing. So, I ended up
settling on a brand called Organics, which when I read the ingredients, it's not the best, it's not the worst, and it's kind of affordable for someone that might be looking in for it. And I went with like the Moroccan oil line. I've been thinking about switching to regular just Moroccan oil shampoo because I took Liz's advice and have been doing henna hair color. And so I know the salon that does that locally sells some of those cool oil shampoos. So I might be investigating into some of that. But there are brands that people can find at a grocery store that are better than others. So if you're not, you know, if you're using Suave today and you're not quite ready to make the no poo plunge, like, you know, you can make steps on that letter towards that direction, which is kind of where I am right now. So
not to belabor the point. Oh, go ahead. Is that you, Haley?
No, it's okay. You can go.
I just, people also probably need to check their fabric softeners. If they're using fabric softeners, their detergents, their hand soaps, a lot of hand soaps will have triclosan in them. There are a lot of kind of sneaky things that may be exacerbating food or skin sensitivities that we don't necessarily think of. So that's another place to go as well.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I did the no poo thing for a little while, but I did kind of give up on it. And I hate to say that I gave up on something, but there is a brand of shampoo that I use, and I really like it. And it's kind of like, I mean, there's got to be a bunch of crap in it. I'm kind of scared to look, but I do know it's gluten-free. And it's the Biomega brand, and you can get it in like a lot of salons. And so it's kind of like a way to be like, oh, well, I'm still using gluten-free shampoo, but you're getting like salon quality stuff. So that is a nice thing. And then I forgot to mention that I usually almost solely use the Holistics brand argan oil on my hair. And I did use Moroccan oil for a while, but what I like about the Holistics brand argan oil is that it's just pure oil. There's nothing else in it except for argan oil. So that's another good hair product. Like, I'll use it. I have really curly hair, and I'll just use that to straighten my hair. It works really well. And then you can put a little more on to just kind of smooth it and kind of smooth the ends a little bit after your hair's dry. So that's another good one too. Yeah, I think that's it.
Cool. On episode 6, which was a weight loss show with Stephanie Ruper from Paleo for Women, we got into some really good emotional discussions, as well as the science of weight loss in women and were the important factors of prioritizing health are. So in this question, we're going to talk about, is there anything that we wish we knew before we were paleo? But there's a lot of really good topics within this question, so enjoy.
Anything that you know now on the other side of your weight loss that you wish you knew before you started your journey?
For me personally, I wish that I would have known more about adrenal fatigue and cortisol and going too low carb and thyroid function. Those are all pretty complicated topics, so I don't think that you need to look into that your first couple of months, but over time, the lower my carbs got and the more digestive distress that I had from not having a gallbladder, it took me a really long time to kind of figure that stuff out. And then I didn't do a very good job of taking care of myself for a portion of the time, mostly when we were working on and marketing our book, that I wasn't sleeping and I was over-caffeinating or I was dark chocolating myself into adrenal fatigue as I exhausted myself. So, if there was anything that I felt like someone needed to know early on in paleo, it would be less about food and more about just relax. Trust that you're doing the right thing. Don't freak out when people ask you about fiber and heart attacks from all the fat you're eating and how you're going to get your calcium. You know, trust that there are a lot of scientific sources out there that you're making the right decision, that you're absolutely correct in thinking that a gastric bypass is going to
first of all, not solve your problems with disordered food eating. You're going to simply have a physical suppression of being able to eat, and that there are very high statistics on people gaining weight back from a gastric bypass and then not being able to properly absorb the nutrients because you're missing a part of your digestive tract. And it can also cause problem with, you know, hair loss and fingernails and fertility, and a lot of things come from not being able to absorb your nutrients. So, you know, don't give yourself a month or two, give yourself a year to really adapt to this lifestyle, figure out how to make it work for you, and trust that you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I might just throw in that you're saying that your weight loss has been very slow at a half pound to a pound a week. That's a great rate to lose weight. You know, basically anywhere between half a pound and 2 pounds a week, slow and steady wins the race. It is much easier to keep it off if you have lost it slowly. And as much as it's really rewarding to see the scale drop really quickly, you know, it's, your eyes are on the prize, the long haul, and you can do it.
And to put it in perspective, that's still 25 to 50 pounds a year. Like, that's a good amount of weight that any doctor would be happy to see. So,
yeah, this is Stephanie, and I would just like to throw in quickly that I one time wrote a piece about the healthiest, happiest, easiest weight loss in the world, and it's exactly what Stacy and Sarah are talking about, right? Healthy because it maintains your hormonal balance and your metabolic fire, which is really important. Trust me, when you get down to lower numbers and you really want to have a metabolism that still works, it's that's really important. And so that's healthy. It's happy because you're not worrying about what foods you're putting in your body. You know you're putting in the healthful foods, and you know that they're healing you, which is great. And I called it easy because you weren't restricting calories and you weren't fighting a battle. But I had to go back and I had to tell people, actually, this is really hard. And here's why. Because you have to accept that. Like, you have to accept that your progress is going to be 50 pounds a year, which is a lot, right? It's really a lot. And we can't want things to be so immediate. Immediate things don't happen. Things happen in progress. And so that's why it's hard and easy at the same time.
Yeah. And you didn't put on the weight in a couple of weeks. So it's not going to all
come unless
off.
You're me.
Well,
yeah. Unless you're me in a prednisone induced giant binge. But yeah.
But even then, that's an unnatural weight gain. I just think, you know, relax, trust your body and the process and the diet, and everything will be all right. I've been at the same weight for a year, and I don't care. Actually, Stephanie, one of the questions I have for you, maybe we can address it before I forget.
Right. Yep.
Is I actually did some reading after our podcast about hormones and weight set points, and found that there's some speculation that women hit a plateau or a set point or whatever you want to call it at the weight which their puberty was onset, and that's kind of, for you, I'm asking in particular because you focus a lot on fertility, and the kind of justification and the reasoning behind this would be that that's when your body says, whoop, time to make babies. This is what fertility looks like for this woman. And so your body maybe takes a snapshot of what your weight and your hormone kind of looks like, and it thinks this is what fertility is. And so when you kind of hit that point, it doesn't want you to go any lower because it's afraid that you might not be fertile anymore. Do you think this is hokey pokey craziness, or do you think there's something to this? And I ask because I've toyed a lot with a lot of different avenues of losing weight over the last year, and no matter what I do, either totally wrong or doing everything right, my weight always seems to balance back to what my weight is now, which is kind of what I hit at puberty. And so it's interesting to me to think that my body is clearly really wanting to be at this weight, and it would take an unhealthy effort for me, in my opinion. It would be an unhealthy mental process for me, let's put it that way, to get below 200 pounds and kind of continue to lose weight. I think I would be more causing problems from an emotional food standpoint than just right now. I'm kind of relaxed. I'm eating what I want and I'm super healthy. I have absolute perfect health. And so I'm just not really worried about it. And, it's a lot to ask, but
no, I have a lot of answers. I was, eager to jump in and hearing a lot of things that I could speak to. Of course, it's not crazy. I don't know where you were reading these things, but I advocate this. I tell people this a lot on my website. There are some points of it that I don't talk about often because I know that the weight at which you are sitting right now is still overweight. Correct me if I'm wrong. And
absolutely.
And women don't want me to tell them that they're going to be overweight forever. And so, and I don't, if you don't want that to be the case, like, I don't think it has to be the case. I don't think it's the case for every single person. I think we're all totally different. I think some people get hardwired at puberty. I think some people have more flexibility. I really do. And that's from what I've witnessed. I personally believe that what happens, it's a hormonal developmental issue. And so I think that our weight, or at least our nutritional status at puberty, is important. But there's a whole lot of other things going on as well, such as our stress, such as our sleep. And so there's an excellent book on this topic. It's called, it's by Wenda Trevathan, Travathan. And I linked to it. Oh, it's called Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives. I linked to it from my website because it's so excellent. And it kind of demonstrates why some women can be thin their whole lives and menstruate, and some women can lose weight and stop menstruating, like me, for example. Some women live, I believe that the key is probably leptin and estrogen, and women live in environments in which these hormone levels are really low. They have low body fat, etc., and they might be living the savannah and eating crickets, right, for their diet, but their leptin levels are really low, so their whole lives they're fine with that kind of leptin level. But if I have a certain amount of body fat and I lose estrogen stores and I lose leptin stores when I lose body fat, and it goes below what my body got used to in it, whatever hormonal environment I was in growing up during puberty, then it's my body's going to detect starvation, and that's just it. There are other things that influence the behavior of our hypothalamus, though. However, like I was saying, stress is very important. Sleep is important. The types of food we're eating is important, whether or not we're eating soy and stuff like that. And the extent of our metabolic damage, how much we've dieted throughout our lives, these are all really important things. And so, no, I don't think it's quite as black and white as this weight and that weight. But I think it's a huge piece of the puzzle. And I think really the best thing we can do for that is to eat intuitively and to be mindful of that and to not try and push beyond it, especially if it feels emotionally or physically detrimental, both of which it probably is.
I totally agree. But I do want to add that the one component that makes me comfortable with this, because it's taken me a really long time to be comfortable with this, is that I, on paper, am 10 times more healthy than 90% of the population. You know, I have perfect markers of health. And so for me, I think, like, you summed it up really nicely. And I don't want to say you validated how I feel, but it is nice to, like, have someone else say, because I get tired of reading all the things on the internet that's like, okay, well, you're clearly not doing what you need to do to lose more weight because being overweight isn't healthy or ideal, and therefore you're not doing it right. And I think for those people, they've never been metabolically deranged. You know, like, when you say something like that, you've never been an emotional eater and you've never been 336 pounds. And I've done a lot in the past year in terms of stressing my body out, unstressing it out, taking supplements, sleeping more, focusing on my health, focusing on, you know, a bunch of different things, relaxing on sugar, being tight with sugar, you know, all the kind of things that I could possibly do to see, okay, well, is it an insulin problem? Is it a cortisol problem? Is it a leptin problem? To try to balance my hormones. And what I've determined is that they seem pretty solid. Like, no matter what I do, it's pretty consistent. Yeah, I can drop weight from going low sugar. I lose about 10 pounds. And then as soon as I eat any carbs at all, and by low sugar, I'm talking fruit and dense carbohydrates, then I gain back most of the weight because it was all water to begin with. So that's not to say that all of you interested in losing weight shouldn't be interested in losing weight, but because it is a weight loss show and I want to be honest and open with people here, you know, if you're losing a pound a week, you should be thrilled with that. And if you don't lose a pound a week and you're gaining health and you're gaining happiness, you should also be really happy with that because you're not gaining weight anymore, which is probably where you started from. So
it's also really common for especially women to sort of hit 10 to 15 pounds away from their goal weight, which is where I'm at, and just not be able to lose any more weight. And that really comes down to sort of a stored fat that is really, really hard for your body to access, which is, you know, tied in with hormones as well. And
starvation prevention.
And starvation prevention, and it's related to the whole idea of set point. And I have been at this weight for, what, about 10 months. And I, too, have tried all different kinds of things. And I really just now am focused on healing rather than losing weight because I still have an autoimmune disease that is not in remission. It's improving, but it is still there. And so I sort of decided that healing was more important than losing weight. And I think women just need to know when you look at the charts and you say, okay, I'm 5'6", I should weigh 135 pounds, you might not get there. And that's okay because you'll still look fabulous.
Right. So this is Stephanie. And if I can reply very quickly to both of your responses. So Stacey, I would just like to not correct, but to put a caveat onto what I said, which is I was thinking primarily about fertility set points. And I believe that a fertility set point is a little bit more set in stone than a weight set point. I believe that weight set points can be more flexible. I believe that the set point isn't necessarily in terms of weight determined by puberty so much as metabolic damage and things that have happened to us. And so, right, I'm not taking that statement back because I believe that puberty is important for your weight status. But as a matter of fact, I believe that it is more metabolic damage that influences weight more so than it is puberty. Puberty, however, is crucial for reproductive fitness, which is why the menstruation problems come into play when people lose weight. And then my second response is to what Sarah was saying. And I remember when I first came upon Sarah's kind of landmark post about this was my body transformation. And there were photos of you, Sarah, doing yoga. And you said, I still want to lose 10 pounds.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at those photos and I'm going, this is such a beautiful, powerful, life and springy looking woman with perfect teeth, by the way.
Thank you.
No, but I just remember your glorious smile, but your body as well in those yoga poses. And to me, I was presuming the body fat was around your hips and I could not even see it. And that's the thing is we have from society these ideas of goal weights and why, oh my goodness, like why shouldn't we not, like Sarah, you were saying, like, should we not have a goal? Health and weight gets to tag along with that. And that's clearly been Stacey's journey and she's totally kicking butt. And it's a really powerful shift weight is certainly important, but as a part of becoming healthy. And being attractive is important, and feeling comfortable in your skin and feeling like you can move around and leap and have love and be able to hug your husband and feel close to each other. Stacey, I remember when you talked about that with you and Matt, and I found that really touching. Those things are super important, and that's why, and for health, I believe that weight loss is so important. But the idea of having an ideal when really what we have is so good and so beautiful already, I just want to caution you listeners to weight loss traps that we get stuck in. Like, it's not going to define anything. It's not going to make anything necessarily.
I was wearing Spanx.
Me too. But I also talked about being totally okay with wearing Spanx because when you've lost over 100 pounds, you're going to have extra skin. And I like that skin to be correctly gravitationally placed. So
I part of my 10 pounds that I want to lose is extra skin that's probably not gonna magically disappear, and I'm okay with that because it's my, you know, badge of warriorness, that being the best phrase ever.
If you missed our recent episode 24 with Julie Bauer, which we called Advice from a Single Lady, then you might have missed this question that really applies to everyone, which is, what are some quick and easy paleo snacks? So some great ideas from three ladies who blog about recipes on what we recommend to eat on the go. And I'll go ahead and break the surprise for you. Someone's going to recommend sardines and someone else is going to think that's a terrible idea.
That most of these questions are from Julie's Facebook wall. Our first question is actually from one that was submitted to the podcast, but I thought it was kind of a fun one for Julie to answer. It's from Sean from Louisville. Does Louisville, Kentucky?
Louisville for some Louisville? People, but yeah, go for it.
All right. I tried.
Did I get that right? Because Julie's laughing at me. Did I not do it right? Because I'm the worst at geography.
I don't know. We have a Louisville in Colorado. That's how we say it here.
No. Louisville? In Kentucky, you just skip the S.
Yeah, don't use that.
Louisville?
Whatever.
Yeah. Sorry, Kentucky. I just apologize to the entire state. Sean writes, I am trying to do paleo. My wife is kind of into it, but she is a huge snackaholic. What are some quick, good, and easy comfort paleo foods for my wife so I can convince her to put down the chips and Sprite?
Okay, well, for snacks, especially someone who's just starting paleo and is very unsure about it, muffins are a great little snack because we've all with a snack, depending how we grew up. And muffins, you can make pretty dang good muffins that don't really taste paleo that much. And that might be a good, easy switch over from like chips and Sprite, or even finding a good brand of sweet potato chips. So she does have that kind of crunch. I tend to go when I need a crunch is like, sweet potato chips or plantain chips to have that. And then the comfort style foods, I really like, even getting like sweet potatoes with some cinnamon on it, it has more of that, you know, that carby comfort that we think of. So I would say muffins, if she likes sweet potatoes, doing sweet potatoes and maybe some cinnamon on top of it is like a later snack. And finding some of those chips out there that most of them are you're going to find have a weird oil that isn't paleo conducive, but you can find pretty good brands out there nowadays in Whole Foods or some of those specialty food stores.
Yeah, my kids love banana chips with coconut oil. Like, we can buy those. Making your own chips is easy, but if you're just starting paleo, then, you know, you can find brands of banana chips with coconut oil. And also kale chips are another really good, easy thing. And people are often really surprised at how good kale chips are. Like, I'll have people
yummy.
Yeah, people who aren't paleo will come to my house and I'll have them out on a spread and they'll be like, what is this? It's really good. I'm like, it's kale. So,
never guess that after you make them into chips ever that they were a vegetable.
Yeah, yeah. And, one of my kids' favorite snacks, but also as an adult, I steal it all the time. Is carrots with guacamole, and you can buy Holy Guacamole brand, and it's totally clean, and that you can literally pick up at the store, right? Like, you can buy carrots already prepped, you can buy guacamole already prepped, and it's a good, quick, easy snack, and apples with sun butter.
Yeah. I'd say apples with, well, almond butter, but sun butter would be sort of similar, some kind of nut butter. That was, like, my go-to snack when I first transitioned to paleo. That was.
I feel like sun butter tastes more like peanut butter for people who are, like, just transitioning. I felt like sun butter was better.
And there's a whole world of different nut butters out there, so you can really play. And I did sort of like homemade trail mixes was sort of one of the other things where I just, you know, grabbed some of my various, you know, favorite flavored. And I usually actually more just mixed nuts rather than dried fruit. Dried fruit was more for the kids, but mixed nuts were just one of
and
my
coconut
go-tos.
Flakes.
Yeah. Yeah, back in the, I miss nuts.
Yeah. The other thing I just thought of too is cured meats. You know, Sarah and I talk about it a lot. We like the U.S. Wellness Meats brands and the Applegate brands. You can get salami or roast beef. Like, I like to get roast beef and I mix up like a horseradish mayonnaise kind of just quick two ingredient thing and dip my roast beef in there as a good snack. So there's a lot of really good choices. You have to think outside the box, you know, just literally think outside of something in a box. And
but sometimes it's just, you know, like veggies and dip, but you're going to have to make your own dip. Or, you know, like there's lots of sort of normal, you know, probably things that are already on your snack list. And it just requires like substituting out one ingredient to make sure that it's uses healthier fats and stuff like that.
And the caramelized coconut chips from The Clothes Make the Girl, we've mentioned it before, but it's a really good popcorn replacement. Like for people who snack, oftentimes they have a popcorn thing, and I personally find that that recipe tastes just like kettle corn to me. So,
yum.
Have you tried that one, Julie?
I haven't.
Oh, it's so good.
I went and tried it
after I mentioned it.
After you mentioned it and told me I had to go try it, I think I like made it like the next day. And it's definitely got that kind of like salty, sweet, crunchy. I think I'm kind of a purist when it comes to coconut. I kind of just like it straight. But I enjoyed it and then I kind of never made it again.
Oh, well. Well, hopefully that helps.
Yeah.
The state of Kentucky.
And whatever your city's name is called. Yeah.
Segment this week, paleo parenting. All right, well, I realize it's been a long show. I hope that you've enjoyed what we've put together for you so far. We wanted to try to have a complete show, and one of the segments that we often neglect is our paleo parenting segment. So we've pulled one of our most favorite responses to paleo parenting, although we do recognize that it's pretty long, so feel free to listen to the rest of this at your leisure. But we have Danielle from Against All Grain on from episode 13, our autoimmune protocol part 2 show, where we talk about how we manage being mothers and prioritizing our own health for sake of autoimmune conditions in this section for paleo parenting. Paleo parenting section, we have the privilege of a special guest. Danielle from Against All Grain has joined us graciously once again. Danielle, I think you were on one of our earlier shows talking about kids. And,
yes.
Because you have an autoimmune condition, Sarah and I thought it would be great to kind of bring you on today to talk about how you also deal with, you know, being a parent and having autoimmune and how we focus ourselves. So welcome to the show. And if you can give our audience who may not have met you before a little intro to what you do and all that jazz, it would be great.
Sure. Yeah. I'm Danielle, as they said, and my blog is againstallgrain.com, which I started just last year after going on the specific carbohydrate diet for my autoimmune condition, ulcerative colitis. And now over the last probably 5 or 6 months, the blog is kind of translated more into the paleo diet lifestyle. So I do all recipe posts. So there's about 200 grain-free recipes up there right now and continue to post a couple a week. And I'm also working on a cookbook. So there's a lot more to come from me.
Congratulations.
That's yeah, very cool.
In a short amount of time.
Thanks.
This week for paleo parenting, as I mentioned earlier, we just have the general topic of, you know, how we each of us as mothers with our own autoimmune issues and diseases manage to prioritize our individual health within our families, given the competing needs of what our bodies needs, what our family needs, what has to be done in our lives, you know, chores, cooking, cleaning, paying the bills, sleeping, running a blog, making sure our children bathe more than once a week, that kind of thing. we do have a specific question with that in mind. Question number one, what are the most important factors for you to manage your autoimmune disease? We have obviously some of the key pointers that we mention often: sleep, diet, exercise, stress management. You know, are there other things that we kind of do as mothers that help us manage our disease and our health
better? Yeah.
Danielle, you want to take
the Sure. I'm sitting in a closet right now, so that's like my answer is just go to a closet. No. I have a really noisy 2-year-old, and so I'm my husband's with him downstairs, but the house carries a lot of noise, so I'm in a closet, getting my time of rest without him. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hard because your kids are your first priority, and it's, you know, they take a lot out of you, and I have to remind myself constantly that stress is a huge fuel of, you know, autoimmune and my disease in particular, and that I just have to slow down every once in a while, which sounds a little hypocritical considering I've got a blog and a book and a whole bunch of stuff that probably stresses me out more than it should, and that I should let it. But I just have to take the time for myself. I do yoga and I do the bar method. And that's kind of that time where I just get to, even though I'm exercising or whatnot, but I get to kind of be without Asher and just some time of kind of quiet. And then cooking for me is it's actually a stress reliever for me. I love being in the kitchen. And when I'm in there, most of the time I'm by myself. He likes to cook with me every once in a while, which is a great bonding experience for us. But that's kind of where I go, is into the kitchen when I need to just kind of clear my head. And so that's big. I think it's just finding the things, the outlets for you that can help, you know, bring some solace into your life, and just to try to breathe and not let the kids, you know, get you too stressed out. We just made a temporary move for the last, we've been here now for a month, and Asher had the worst time ever acclimating and just not wanting to nap. And it's, you know, like 100 degrees here. And so he's confused about why we left home and why he's sweating all the time. And it definitely started to take a toll on my health because I was letting his, you know, how he was doing affect me. And every time I'd battle for 2 hours for a nap with him, I could like feel my stomach churning. and so I had to just take a step back and say like, okay, I just need to let him be a 2-year-old and, you know, just keep at it. But I can't let it affect me as much as it is, because I will end up getting sick in the end. And then, you know, I can't take care of him at all, which is where I've been in the past. So it's a constant thing that I'm having to remind myself, and that my husband's having to remind myself or remind me of, which is great for him. And, you know, he's asked me like, well, am I nagging you, or does it help you? And I'm like, yeah, I need that reminder, especially for people who are type A like myself, which a lot of us type A are the ones that get those autoimmune diseases. You know, so it's like I need him kind of there saying, hey, take a break or go do this, or, you know, and it's great to have him there for that. So otherwise, we try to utilize family as much as possible, just for a break for both of us, you know. And I stay at home, so I sometimes will get, you know, like a friend to help out with him a couple times a week if I just need some time to rest or things like that, just play dates and things to help help give you a little bit of time to yourself.
It's interesting you said that your husband kind of encourages you, because I have the wonderful gift of also having that.
Yes.
That last night was just, I was staying up way too late working on a project. And he came in several times and he's like, you know, gently afraid to get his head bitten off. Like, well, I just want to let you know it's midnight.
Yeah.
So how about you, Sarah?
For me, I think the most important thing is to prioritize sleep. Like if I don't get enough sleep, then it doesn't matter how clean my diet is. It actually is way harder to keep my diet clean if I didn't get enough sleep. Like I just have way more cravings. My ability to manage stress isn't as good. I get more moody. I get shorter with the kids. So I'm like snapping at them. So if I can keep sleep and that part of the puzzle together, then everything else falls into place easily. And if I let myself, you know, get wrapped into watching a movie with my husband after I already worked all night on a blog post, then I'm a complete wreck. And I'm a complete wreck for days because I have two young kids who are up at 6 a.m. every day. And if I don't go to bed, I still have to get up when they get up. There's no like letting mom sleep in thing in our house, unfortunately. So for me, like that has to be like my top priority, is making sure that I drag myself to bed at 9 o'clock every night. And if I stay up till 10, then I feel it. And then I have to go to bed at 8:30 the next night to make up for it. So if I can do that, then everything else sort of falls into place. And if I let that slide, and I do let that slide frequently because I'm an adult, and when my kids go to bed, like there's like 6 hours worth of things that I want to do, and I only really have about 2.5 hours to do them in. So it's a constant struggle to sort of remind myself that like I need sleep. I need it. And if I can't get it, then I'm not going to be able to do all of these other things. So I try and be as efficient as I can throughout the day so that I do have some downtime after the kids go to bed. But I give up a lot. Like my husband and I, we don't really watch TV anymore because we don't have time to watch shows because I have to go to bed early. And so that's sort of, you know, like I also, like Danielle, you know, really try and protect my exercise time. And I also do yoga. And now that I can only do yoga twice a week, I'm playing with some other things to fill in that really important third workout for me. But I protect that time as well, but I can't even drag myself to my local YMCA for a yoga class if I don't get enough sleep. Like sleep's my absolute number one priority.
Well,
what about you?
Yeah, I think I'm still working on it. I mean, to be really honest, I don't want to pretend to be saying that I figured this out, because honestly, I haven't been as mentally unhealthy or physically as unhealthy since I realized I had an autoimmune disease like 4 months ago, maybe. So it's really taken an emotional toll on me that I've been battling, mainly because I have emotional eating disorders. And I knew how to manage that within a paleo framework and had gotten really good at it. And then when I had to take away a lot of additional foods, it caused an emotional toll on me. It made me, when I took away nuts, it made me have this like crazy emotional thing where I wanted to bake things that didn't contain nuts. Like I went out of my way. I hadn't been baking things or eating baked goods for a long time, other than occasionally, but I had gotten kind of past that initial paleo phase where you bake a lot and had moved into the phase where I very occasionally wanted something. As soon as I realized I couldn't have nuts, it made me go crazy with wanting to find alternative ways to still eat cookies or still eat cakes or still eat whatever. And
I totally understand that.
Yes, it's fine.
I really want to be like
honest with our listeners about that, because for me, like, I'm still at the managing my emotions part. Like, I've been honest with people since I was at my lowest weight a year and some change ago. I've gained 15 pounds, and I'm kind of sitting at that 15-pound mark. I'm not continuing to gain, but I've had to kind of back off of saying that losing weight's no longer my priority, that managing my autoimmune disease and managing my health and my emotional wellness is really important. So for me, it's been a lot about, like, being honest with myself and being honest with Matt, like, what's going on? Why do I want these things more often than I've ever wanted them before? It is a lot of sleep. And Sarah, when you talk about how important sleep is for you, I'm like, yeah, I had a pretty bad, like, eating day the past couple of days, and that's because I haven't been sleeping. And then because I eat more sugary foods, like, it makes me not want to go to sleep. Like, I have more of an up, you know, after
9 p.m. That happens too.
Yeah, it's a terrible cycle that I'm still working through. I have noticed, though, since there's something about reading the Practical Paleo Stress Management section and the autoimmune book that really set a light bulb off in my head, and I have really been focusing on stress management. We made some decisions within our family, like, we were going to move. We were going to sell our house and buy a new house this year, and we decided not to do that because we had too many other things going on. And, like, the sole reason that I decided not to do that was because I knew that I couldn't handle it. That, like, the idea of going out and looking at houses with the realtor was literally giving me, like, anxiety attacks. I was grinding my teeth. I wanted to eat badly. And so I said to Matt, I'm like, I just can't do this. You know, we don't have to move. The house is totally fine for another year. It's just, it's not worth my health to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so for me, the priority has been on kind of, I'm new to the recognition of having an autoimmune disease. And it's really kind of recognizing my own limitations and dealing with the emotional repercussions of having to tell myself no. And, that's where I am right now. And I started incorporating back exercise. Yoga and family walks has been really awesome and helpful to both my physical and my emotional well-being. So, but when I get really overwhelmed and stressed out, those are the first things to kind of come out of the picture, because as good as they may be for me, if I start to feel stressed out and guilty that I haven't done yoga, which is what ends up happening with me, I'm like an... My family jokes that it's kind of a Catholic mindset. My family's Catholic, and they're really good at being guilty. And I'm not saying that all Catholics are, but my family's really good at guilt. And I think it's just part of how I learn to inner cope with things, is I make myself feel guilty. Like, oh, you shouldn't have done that, or you should have done this. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of grinds away and stresses me to the point where, you know, it's like, it was never worth being upset about. And now I'm, like, overwhelmed with guilt or frustration or whatever. So that's my honest stab at that, I guess.
Yeah, that's great. That's where I had to start there too. So you'll get there. I had to hit rock bottom before I actually realized that I had to make my health a priority. I was in the hospital for like 2 weeks, and I couldn't even carry my son up the stairs to his bed for like a good month and a half. And then I kind of, the light bulb went off, and I was like, oh, I can't let this happen again, because I'm his mother. And, you know, if I let this get this bad again, then I won't be able to do what I'm supposed to be doing for him. And so over the last year, that's kind of where I've been, is trying to get there. But that, yeah, definitely before that, I was in that same place and very emotional about it. And it took, you know, I mean, even changing my diet took like a good year before I finally was like, realized that I actually had to do it.
Well, good. I'm glad. I think it's normal. And
yeah, definitely.
I think part of why I'm able to be kind of honest and open about it is so that our listeners who may themselves be realizing that they have an autoimmune disease, that it's okay to kind of go through the normal phases of like, where am I in this whole thing? And, you know, having Sarah as someone I can talk to, having Diane from Balance Bites as someone I can call and text and cry. those kinds of things are really great for me that I don't know that everybody has. So hopefully they can at least feel some comfort in knowing that.
Yeah. And not alone. One thing that I have to say that I often find that whatever I need to do to keep my autoimmune disease in check is a moving target. And if I have, you know, something change that's not in my control, to, you know, something happened that's not in my control, or
something added to my plate that wasn't something that I needed, it can be really, really hard to find that balance again. And it can be really hard to sort of like figure out how to, you know, keep my priorities and make sure that I'm looking after myself, but then still get, you know, all of the things I was getting done before. And now there's this extra thing. And that, I think that's just like life, like that just happens. You sort of, as soon as you feel like everything is coming together, you know, there'll come some new surprise that you weren't expecting. And, I don't know that I have any really good advice for how to adjust other than do the best you can.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, it definitely is true. Like I was just starting to kind of get comfortable and get in my groove at home. And then, you know, my husband's job changed and we moved to Hawaii, which sounds like it would be so relaxing because it's Hawaii, but it's not a vacation. So, and I mean, I think the only advice I can offer and that people always tell me, and I have a hard time with it, is just ask for help. You know, I mean, we can't, as much as we want to and we think we can't do it all on our own. And so that's the thing people kept encouraging me to do, is just like ask people for help. You know, like if you need help packing, then ask. And, you know, I had just so many people that were so generous and willing to help me. And it definitely helped a lot for me, because I would have taken it all on myself if it was left to me. So,
yeah, so that's me too.
In that same vein, I guess, you know, another question that I think, you know, we all probably hear in this context and in others is, you know, it's great we have helpers. We've mentioned that we have a spouse that kind of encourages us to lay low and helps. Do we have words of wisdom or advice for those people that either don't have a spouse or whose family might not be as supportive or understanding as to the utter importance of stress management and sleeping and diet and exercise to managing an autoimmune disease?
I think it's really important to find a support network, whether that is your family or your friends or your local community center or your church or your PTA or, you know, whatever local group is around, that there's going to be some people who, you know, maybe it's your neighbors, your local housing association, that, you know, I live like 3,000 miles away from my family. And so I see, you know, I see my mother once a year and I see my mother-in-law twice a year because she's retired and can travel more. And so I, for a few weeks, every few months, I have some help. And then the rest of the time I don't. I just have, you know, the friends that I have here, which aren't, you know, I'm starting to get some closer friends, but I don't have a really strong, support network here. I don't know who I would call at 2 a.m. if I needed help at 2 a.m. But I do have, a really great thing going with my local YMCA, because there's a really good sense of community through there. And I see the same people over and over again. And I know all of the daycare people, and I know it's a place that my children are happy, and I, use them a lot. And then there's people that I've met through there who, you know, I've been able to start like, well, I didn't start, my friend started, a babysitting co-op where there's three of us and we take turns watching the other one's toddlers so that we can go volunteer at our older kids' schools. And I guess, you know, like I find community in strange places. I find community at the farmer's market. This morning at the farmer's market, I was carrying a bushel of apples to my car, and my, not quite 3-year-old decided that she was not going to the car again. Thank you very much, Mom. So my meat farmer watched her for the 3 minutes it took me to take her to the car. And I felt like completely comfortable with that because I've chatted with my meat farmer every single week for the last, you know, 6 months since I found this market, which I found because one of my yoga teachers at the YMCA mentioned this farmer's market one morning. So, so I think, you know, you find that community wherever you can, and it is out there. And, you know, you can always, depending on what autoimmune disease you have, there's a lot of online support groups. Online communities can be really powerful. And even though those aren't people that can necessarily come into your house and watch your kids so you can have a nap, there's still that sense that somebody understands what you're going through is so important. There's support groups that'll be run through hospitals and treatment centers. So, you know, it might be take a little proactivity on your part to find those support groups. But that's they're out there. You can find those people. And then sort of the more you get out and the more people you find, the easier it is to sort of shore up that that support around you so that you can figure out how to balance everything.
Yeah, I agree with all of that for sure. The community thing is huge. And it's, I don't know if it's just, you know, moms in my generation or what it is, but every time I talk to my mom and I need help with something, you know, with Asher, she's like, well, when you guys were kids, we would just switch off with our friends. Like I'd watch theirs for one day and then they'd watch you guys. And so I'd have it half a day to myself. And she's like, why don't you guys do that anymore? And I was like, oh, I don't really know. You know, it's mostly because I can't even imagine having another 2-year-old running around right now. but I've started to kind of try to do that with some of my friends, which has been great because babysitting can just get so expensive, you know, and so that's been really helpful. And now that he's older too, I think it's a little harder when they're really young, but yeah, definitely all those things you said, you know, wherever you can find it, take it. And obviously that's the physical helping part. But like you said, like the online boards. And I mean, I know when I was first diagnosed, I just spent hours combing through all the different, you know, threads of people's symptoms and things like that. And it really is, it's really comforting to know that someone's been where you've been and to know that you're not, you know, the only one. And even though you don't know those people, it's huge. And that's probably for me, the biggest reward of my blog is just being able to help people. You know, I mean, I get hundreds of emails a week, mostly from either women that are my age that have just been diagnosed or, you know, people with little kids that have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis and just asking questions about how to manage it and what to do. And I love to be able to respond. And I, you know, I personally respond to each of those emails and hope to be able to do that as long as possible. But don't be afraid to email people that you find online. You know, I mean, they started their blogs for that reason, to help people. And I know that there were a couple blogs out there when I first started 5 years ago, and I was emailing back and forth with those people quite a bit. And that was so helpful to me. So I would encourage you to really seek out the boards and, you know, just talking to people about things.
And each of us has a Facebook page that I know yeah. we're all active on, and there are tons of users like us that are also active that sometimes when I don't get to a question in time, you know, I see other people in the group respond and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I'm totally exactly. happy when my Facebook page is used as a support group for people. You know, people are... Totally am happy when people post, you know, help, I need this, questions on my wall. And people are always welcome to do that.
Right.
The only other thing that I would add, because I think that's pretty much 98% of it, but where it's possible sometimes if a family or a spouse or someone is actively being unsupportive, perhaps they just need a little education from mm-hmm. someone on the fact that, you know, if you do have an autoimmune disease, what that means and what the, you know, medical opinion is on how to improve it. Because even, you know, even mainstream doctors will tell people with autoimmune disease that stress and sleep are priorities yep. in terms of body healing. So, you know, if you have a family member that just complains that you're lazy or tired or whatever all the time and can't understand why, you know, XYZ, if there's a way to nicely educate them on, well, this is a symptom of my autoimmune disease and, you know, I have to rest or I have to eat funny or I have to do whatever it is that they're making fun of you for because of it. I find that a little education can sometimes go a long way, but other than that, you know, look for people that do understand if you can't is great. So,
yeah.
Well, Danielle, do you have anything else that you would like to contribute before we bid you adieu?
I don't think so. No, I mean, unless you guys had any other questions, I think.
I don't think so. I think I think that brings our show to a close. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us again.
Yes. Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me. I love being on. It's fun.
I can hear your little one in the background. So enjoy.
Oh, you can? Oh.
No,
shoot.
The
door's not big enough.
No. It, your closet muffled well, but I can hear that he's active and I'm here waiting for you. So thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Of course. Have a good rest of your weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this special episode of The Paleo View. We hope that even if you have listened to all of these episodes before, that you've enjoyed listening to some of our favorites. And we'd love to hear from you on what some of your favorites are. And we look forward to recording live again next week when Sarah hopefully has recovered from her internet woes.
If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I'm only recording a podcast here.
I get bored of you after a while, Stacey.
Let's hope our listeners feel differently.
Keep making that bloop noise over our recording, though.
Matt can always edit. We'll just go for that.
Well, you guys can hang up on Sarah and I, and we're going to do the rest of the show.
Okay.
Thanks,
Sarah.
Thank you.
Nice meeting you all.
Bye. Nice meeting you guys.
Bye. Nice meeting y'all. Bye.
Bye.